Muscle. The podcast is starting.
Hello and welcome to Podtrificus Totalis, a Harry Potter read-along podcast. This week, we are starting Chapter 1 of Prisoner of Azkaban. It's called Owl Post. But first, we're going to introduce ourselves. My name is Cassie.
My name is Joe.
First try. Look at that. I'm so good. It's been a long time.
Well, you've ruined it.
No, I didn't ruin it because this is a good transition because my first note is a dress break.
Excuse me?
As in a dress, it's been quite some time since we last released an episode.
We're going to do that often. We're going to try not to.
Well, we've had this conversation already. Times. Yeah, like four or five times. It's been a while.
Yeah.
We said it would be a little while. Maybe not this long, but we said it would be a little while.
There are some things currently happening that make a lot of things tough.
I don't know if anybody's looked at the news. There is a pandemic, and that makes things tough, especially if you're teachers, especially newer teachers.
Yep.
Grad school also has made things tough for me and psychologically for Joe in some ways, too, even though he's not the one in grad school right now.
Not yet. I get to look forward to that still.
Yeah. So it's been a little while, but here we are.
Yep.
I'm not going to say when we're recording this because it may be sometime between us recording this and releasing it, but it's been a while. So welcome back.
Welcome back. I hope you missed us.
I think people did. I think people woke up every morning. They're like, nuts. Another week without Podtrificus Totalis.
I'll never know what happens in Prisoner of Azkaban.
Because they're reading along
with us. There's no way for me to know without these two people telling me.
Yeah. So we're going to... I don't think we have any major plans as far as changing the show up. We're going to kind of keep doing what we've been doing. It is a priority for us in this book to have guests. We started with Chamber of Secrets, and that's something that we're going to start rolling. But, you know, I thought that the first chapter should be just us. And also, we didn't reach out to anyone as far as being a guest for this chapter. So it's just me and Joe this week. I do want to also just reaffirm that J.K. Rowling is a garbage human who has some particularly transphobic views, which we do not support and which cause real harm to real people. And please do not financially support her in any way.
Yes. Do not buy these books.
Do not buy the merchandise unless it's coming from like a independent creator, hopefully a queer creator, a person of color. You know, vote with your dollar. And
find someone on Etsy who's unlicensed and get a knitted Dobby or something.
Yeah, that sounds great. So we just want to be clear all the time, but especially after a long break, that we do not support J.K. Rowling in any way because she has doubled and tripled and quadrupled down on her horrific views.
Yeah, it was bad when we were last recording. Somehow it's gotten worse. I'm impressed every time and equally horrified.
Yeah. So I just wanted to get that out of the way. So, Prisoner of Azkaban.
Yes, it is my turn to do the chapter summary.
Not yet. I want to start by talking about some background with the book, and then we'll do the chapter summary. Okay. Does that make sense? Does that seem coherent?
Sure.
Let's talk about some background for the book. So, the first British printing of the book was by Bloomsbury Publishing in 1999, in July of 1999, which I wrote good timing next to it because... the book starts in July, like the first chapter is the end of July. So I'm like, hey, that's fun that it kind of times out properly.
Do you think to some extent that was planned?
Actually, I have a note about that. Apparently, according to a website called The Remember All, which has since been deleted, but which I found on archive.org, the book was delayed so that kids wouldn't skip school to read it. Just imagine that. Imagine that being a concern, that children would skip school to read a book.
What a life.
I know. I think that timing is good because the summer means that kids don't really have much to do. So having a book, it's something enriching that they can do. It's nice timing, too, that it works out with the book starting when the book starts.
Yeah.
And when it released. So that was the British printing. It sold over 68,000 copies in 2 days.
Wow.
Yes. The U.S. printing was by Scholastic in October of 1999. So there was a decent buffer there. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind, too, that the internet was not what we thought or well, not how we think of it today. So that buffer may not have been as severe as far as spoilers. There were certainly fan communities around at the time, though. So October of 1999, it came out in the U.S. It was.
Were they less worried about U.S. kids skipping school to read this book?
Maybe. They had to do some localization, but they also know that Americans don't read as much. I mean, although the book did sell very well. So due to the Harry Potter phenomena, particularly with this book, the New York Times created a new and separate bestseller list for children's books because Harry Potter was at the top of the bestseller list, which is what they had at the time, for so long that they're like, we're going to put children's books in their own category. This book was also the first midnight release for a Harry Potter book in the U.S. There was not a midnight in the U.K. at the time. It released at like 3:45 p.m. on a Thursday. But many U.S. bookstores, because the series was so hot at the time, decided to do midnight releases. So this was the first book that would become a tradition for the future ones. And I actually went to one of the midnight releases for Deathly Hallows because that's when I was old enough that my parents could justify dropping me off at a bookstore for midnight release and not staying.
If there's ever...
Actually, I think my mom did stay.
If there's ever a midnight release of anything, I feel like the bookstore one is probably the safest.
Yeah, it was definitely much more low-key than, say, like a midnight release of a movie or a video game.
Yeah, the midnight releases of the Harry Potter movies were chaotic.
I don't know that I ever went to a midnight. I went to the midnight release of... I think the two Deathly Hallows. I don't think I went to a midnight of any of the others.
I was still relatively young when the movies came out, so I didn't go to any of them, but I remember watching the videos. Okay. Like, it was on the news.
Yeah, I mean, it also depends on where you are. We were in kind of a small, sleepy town, so they were pretty low-key, yeah. From what I remember. So, yes, this was the first one that had midnight releases. J.K. Rowling did begin writing this book the day after she finished writing Chamber of Secrets, which is interesting to just go straight from one to the other.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, I mean, you're on a roll.
She had a publisher finally. She was the book was actually picked up, you know?
Yeah. And so I found a quote about that from a USA Today article, which was published in 2004. And this was, she was talking about the release of the movie of Prisoner of Azkaban, but she said about the process of writing the third book that it was the best writing experience she ever had. Of the five books that are published, writing Azkaban was the easiest. And in some ways, I think it shows. I was in a very comfortable place when I wrote number three. Immediate financial worries were over and press attention wasn't yet by any means excessive. So it kind of fell in that sweet spot of the movies hadn't come out yet. Mm-hmm. The first movie didn't come out till November of 2001, I think. And so the series was certainly popular. She had money. She was comfortable. She had a publisher, like you said, but it wasn't like,
let's say, banging down her door looking for interviews. And
yeah.
Things.
It wasn't like the release of Deathly Hallows where it leaked on the internet. So it's interesting that it's in that sweet spot and that it was a positive experience for her writing it because future books, particularly Order of the Phoenix, are quite a slog for her. Mm-hmm. There's some stuff about the publishing of that we'll talk about in 8 to 10 years when we get to that book. So I'm almost done with my background on the book. I do want to talk about the dedication of this book. You know, books are usually dedicated to people. Mm-hmm. We talked about it with Chamber of Secrets, but this one is dedicated to Jill Pruitt and Ian Keeley, the godmothers of Swing. That is what the dedication says. Jill Pruitt and Ian Keeley were two of Rowling's flatmates and good friends from her days in Porto. This is according to the Harry Potter lexicon. Swing does not refer to swing dancing, but rather the name of a disco in Porto, where the three women spent many Saturday nights. And interestingly, the Jill Pruitt dedication may be the source of Molly Weasley's maiden name, which is Pruitt, if you remember.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So that's an interesting one. So I kind of want to talk about our feelings about this book. I'll let you start. Like, what's your history with this book? How do you regard it among the Harry Potter series?
This book I read for the first time as I was reading all of them in one straight shot. I thought it was a good book. Most of the situations where I watched the movie, I was watching it in a string. I did a lot of marathons of the Harry Potter movies. So this was just, you know, another stop on there. It was a solid movie. And I really enjoy the movie and the book. But I don't think I ever, like, went in my way and said, I just want to watch this one. It was usually, like, I'm watching all of them, so I'm watching this one as well.
Okay. Now, you really like the first two movies, correct?
I really like the second movie. The first one's good, though.
Okay. So in watching them, because I don't know that you followed the movies, like, as they released. Like, I was, like, up on the news as of this movie. Like, I was following the pre-release buildup. Did you notice, like, the distinct change? Because there was a change in director, and that kind of upheaved a lot. So, like, when you were marathoning them, were you ever like, hey, this seems real different? Or did it just, was it just, hey, this is another Harry Potter movie?
like, intentionally darker.
Yeah.
And almost like the colors washed out.
Mm-hmm.
Because the first two movies are clearly
they're kids children's movies. Yeah.
Very bright and colorful. But I would say that the movies were darker than they needed to be. Hmm. Like, there was still, like, oh, the fun outfits in those movies. The actors actually got to pick their outfits for the most part. So you got all these, like, they're not in their robes all day long.
Mm-hmm.
Like Hermione's pink jumper.
Yeah.
But other than that, like, there's not really a ton of color in the movie, but the magical world is still very colorful, even if it's not a kid's movie. So
yeah,
it was interesting to see that push towards, let's make this a darker, older movie. I don't know if it was necessary. It was appropriate for the plot of this movie, but I think there still could have been more color.
Okay. Yeah. I don't mean to get too deep into the movies, but this is a turning point, I think, for the series. In that it does start to lean into some darker elements. It does, I think, start to tip into the young adult literature territory. Like, I think the first two are very definitively children's books.
Mm-hmm.
And this one, I feel like, kind of teeters on the edge. And Goblet of Fire, I would say, to an extent, still teeters on the edge. By Order of the Phoenix, I think we're full on in the young adult territory. But this one, I think, is a definite turning point. And it's interesting because when I think of my history with this, like I said, this was the first movie that I was really, like, following the release of. Like, I was reading news about it and, like, watching trailers and, like, looking at the promo pics that were coming out because I was on the internet at the time. Mm-hmm. I think I was 12, actually, because I remember I went to see this movie for the first time for a friend's 13th birthday.
And Harry does turn 13 in this book.
Yeah.
So I could see the argument of, like, this is no longer a kid's movie. It's no longer a kid in the movie.
Yeah.
And we do get some hints of his, like, angsty teen
self.
Yeah.
Not to
the same extent it will be later on, but we're going to get some of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so talk about my experience with this book before. And I've mentioned it plenty of times before. I never regarded this book highly. Like, this was, like, at the bottom of my list of, like, best Harry Potter books for a very long time. I think it's one of the ones that I've reread the least. Like, there were times that I would sit down and be like, I'm going to read all of the Harry Potter books just in a row. But there were other times when I'd be like, I really want to read Chamber of Secrets right now, or I really want to read Half-Blood Prince right now. And I would do that. But I don't think I ever was in a mood where I was like, I really want to read Prisoner of Azkaban, because I didn't care about it, really. I was just like, it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay. And I'm not quite sure why that is. I think that this is an interesting one in that it can kind of stand alone. There are tidbits that build up to that. But I think that if there was any book that you had to tell somebody to read that wasn't familiar with Harry Potter, and for whatever reason the first one wasn't an option, I feel like this is the next one. Because a lot of the characters and the arcs are self-contained.
Okay. I could see that argument.
It's a very different book. In a lot of ways, it breaks a lot of the conventions that the first books have established. And it doesn't have things, I think, that we see in the later books, too.
This is very much like a setup for later ones in a lot of ways.
But so, like, think of it this way, like Star Wars Episode 4, which is a weird example because of the Star Wars, like, chronology and series order. But, like, that one sets up a lot of things. But it all is also self-contained. Like, if if Star Wars ended with just that movie, it'd be like, hey, this is a satisfying ending. This one, I don't think it could have ended here, Harry Potter, but, like, there wasn't, like, a string left over at the ending so much. I don't think. I don't know. It's hard to talk about without spoiling anything. We can talk about
which
it.
Which is
as
why
we keep
I was
going.
Surprised that you asked this question here and not at the end.
Well, I'm talking about like our background with the book before okay. we start reading it. So I never really regarded it highly, and I'm curious about how that will change because I do love, love, love the movie for this book. And when we have watched the movie together, I've always been like, man, maybe Prisoner of Azkaban is the best Harry Potter book. Like, maybe this is really good. And I think part of that might be a testament to Alfonso Cuarón's movie making skills. Mm-hmm. But I think part of it might just be that I have grown and I'm wiser now, and I can appreciate this book for what it is. So that's kind of my background with it. So I'm really excited to reread this book. I do want to share a couple of questions from The Ultimate Unofficial Guide to the Mysteries of Harry Potter by Galadriel Waters, everyone's favorite book other than the Harry Potter books. These are labeled as questions still bugging us. Galadriel tracks some of these things and puts them at the beginning of her explanation of each book. And so I think that they're good to kind of remind our listeners, the readers, and us about some of the lingering mysteries that we have going into this book. Mm-hmm. So the first one is, what happened the night Harry's parents died and why was the house destroyed? How did everyone all know about and communicate the events that took place the night Voldemort attacked the Potters? Why did Voldemort want to kill Harry? Is Dumbledore in control of events? Why does Snape hate Harry so much? And that's it. And so some of those questions, I think, will be partly answered by this book. Some will keep going. I did omit a few because Galadriel gets real hung up on this wild theory about switching spells, which we can talk about at the end of reading this book, because I think it is a very fascinating theory, but a theory that has nothing to do with anything that actually happens in the Harry Potter books. But yeah, I just wanted to bring those up. I do want to share one tidbit, too, that she puts before the book to kind of bridge Chamber of Secrets and Prisoner of Azkaban. This says, in an interview on southwestnews.com, which I don't know what that is exactly. I'm really hoping that it is a news website by the airline Southwest, just because that would entertain me. J.K. Rowling says that because Hagrid was cleared of all wrongdoing and is now a teacher, he can legally do magic. However, since he never finished his education, he is not really good at it. I just thought we should add that in, that as of Chamber of Secrets, Hagrid is cleared of wrongdoing. He is an innocent person and he is allowed to do magic now. Mm-hmm. So that's all I wanted to pull from Galadriel. I don't feel the need to dissect the title Prisoner of Azkaban too much because we already explored what Azkaban is in 212, the Polyjuice Potion.
The prisoner is Hagrid because he was a prisoner of Azkaban.
Yeah, this is the book about Hagrid. That's why it's so different and why it can stand on its own.
Yeah.
So that is the end of my spiel on the background of this book. And I will let Joe get to the chapter summary now. Let me get my phone so I can do the timer for any new listeners. We do challenge ourselves to do a chapter summary in 30 seconds, but I'm setting it and let me know when you're ready.
Harry has been kept away from his books and supplies all summer and picked a lock so he could do his homework in secret in the dead of the night. Ron tried to call Harry, but Vernon answered and Ron innocently yelled at him on the top of his lungs. Now is Harry's birthday. Hedwig, Errol, and another owl bring him letters and gifts from Ron, Hermione, and Hagrid. Ron's letter says his family won money from a giveaway and went to Egypt to visit Bill. And he has a letter from Hogwarts telling him he can get a permission slip signed to go to Hogsmeade.
You did it. Good job. Oh, boy. I actually found a surprising amount to talk about with this book, with this chapter.
Which is interesting because a lot of it really is just recap.
Yes. And I wrote a little bit about that, that like this book does what Chamber of Secrets also did, which is kind of introduce like elementary elements of the series. Like, this is what Muggles are and Harry is a wizard and this is who Voldemort is. Just like the kind of if a kid picked this book up and hadn't read the previous two, they could kind of get what's going on.
Yeah. And they do fill in a lot of those gaps. I do love the opening of this chapter, which is the opening of the book. And they talk about how Harry is an unusual boy because he loves school. He hates summer vacation. Oh, and also he's a wizard.
Yeah. And I think that Rowling kind of uses the frame of Harry writing an essay to tell you a lot of things about the wizarding world and tell you a lot of things about Harry's world. Like, he's writing an essay about witch burnings, which we'll talk about. And then it's like, the Dursleys were pretty medieval in their opinion of witches and wizards, too. And so it's kind of used as a frame. I think it works well enough. But I think it's interesting to see the point at which she stops opening the books this way, which will be book five. Not to give anything away or get too in depth with it, but I do wonder about how much that was like, well, we're on the fifth book now, so they should know what's happening by now. And how much of it was book five was the first book released after the movies started coming out.
So at that point, everyone just knew.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So again, this book is in an interesting spot of being when Harry Potter was really, really popular, but before the movies. So we'll kind of see how that influences things.
And like we said, as soon as she finished writing Chamber of Secrets, she started writing this book.
Yeah.
So like Chamber of Secrets hadn't even come out yet. She didn't know.
Didn't know like the critical reception, you're saying, to Chamber of Secrets?
Well, she didn't know like how popular that one was going to be.
Okay. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
So it still might need that explanation. That...
Yeah, but she knew how popular the series was and like mm-hmm. the anticipation behind Chamber of Secrets. But I get what you're saying. Totally. And it should be noted, too, that this book is a fan favorite, I would say, and a critical favorite, too. I think back to one of my professors from undergrad who was an English professor. I took a grammar class with her, and she repeatedly shared the opinion that this is the best Harry Potter book by a mile. And for the grammar class, we would often have to diagram sentences from this book. So maybe that's what gave it a special place in my heart in the last couple of years that made me turn a corner from it. I was like, I love diagramming those sentences. So I love Prisoner of Azkaban. So this chapter opens up with, like Joe said, the whole like Harry is an unusual boy thing. And one of the things that makes him unusual is he's doing homework at night over summer vacation, like hiding under his covers with a torch, because the ebook that we have is the British edition that was changed to flashlight for the US editions. I'm not going to get too far into like all of those differences, but that one stood out to me. Mostly because the one fault of the movie for this book is that it opens with Harry doing magic.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was a problem.
Yeah. So it's a flashlight in the book, at least.
Yeah. Especially because the last movie.
Yeah.
The movie prior to that opens with Harry getting in trouble because someone else did magic in his vicinity.
Yeah. We forgive you, King. Alfonso Cuarón, you can have that one. It's fine.
It was a cool opening.
It was. It really ruined so,
the like.
I've gotten over my whole like the movie's got things wrong thing. I mean, there were some things that they like egregiously changed that I hate, but like a little thing like that, I'm like, it works for the effect. We need to stop talking about the movie though. It's so good. So Harry is under the covers working on an essay. He is reading A History of Magic, which, if you all will remember, is Hermione's favorite book. Mm-hmm. Early editions of this book listed Adalbert Waffling as the author of A History of Magic, not Bathilda Bagshot. It was corrected in later editions, I believe the American printing that was a few months after and then onward. I'm very curious how that came about, because Bathilda Bagshot does become an important character, but to change it like just a couple months after, I wonder how they caught that.
Was it Bathilda Bagshot
in the first book? I don't think it was mentioned in the first book. I don't think the author was mentioned. Like, I wonder if in the 3 months between the British printing and the US printing, if Rowling was like, oh, well, I need this to be Bathilda because she's going to be important later.
Chapter 5, Diagon Alley. It's in his book list.
And is the author mentioned?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So it was just a mistake, I guess.
Yeah, she just made an error.
Okay.
And we'll see a few more of those, some much more significant than others.
Yeah, but to talk a little bit about Bathilda Bagshot, just the name, because we'll talk about her more in depth when she comes back. But Bathilda is a German name meaning heroine. Bagshot is a town in Surrey, England. It is also the name of the road in which Bilbo, Frodo, and Sam live in Lord of the Rings, Bagshot Row, which would not be the first Lord of the Rings reference in these books. So I'm inclined to believe that that is an origin. I did find something on the Harry Potter wiki about the name Bathilda Bagshot, that it may have been inspired by Walter Bagehot, who in 1867 wrote the book that is considered the most important text on the British system of government. His work, The English Constitution, had nearly the same status in British public schools as History of Magic did at Hogwarts.
Hmm. Okay.
So that's an interesting possibility. Harry did previously find Hedwig's name in A History of Magic. And as we said, it is Hermione's favorite book.
It's a very important book.
So Harry's reading this book and he's working on an essay for History of Magic. And I got a problem here with Professor Binns. I'm going to put on my teacher hat right now and criticize Professor Binns' instructional methods, which is not the first nor the last time that we will do this. But Harry's assignment for this essay is...
Witch burning in the 14th century was completely pointless. Discuss.
This is terrible. Like, I understand, like, just tell them to write about witch burning and, like, tell them to choose a stance on it. At least that's, like, a valuable exercise, not just recite the history of witch burning. It made me think back to when I was in eighth grade, which is about how old Harry is in this book. I had to write an essay about whether dropping the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki was justified. And I'm like, at least that's something that, like, encourages the student to, like, think critically and, form an opinion and make an argument. Whereas this is just like the here is the opinion for you. Write about it.
You can discuss that you disagree.
I don't know about that. Maybe. I don't know. I don't care for this.
That's fair.
I would not assign this essay.
It's an easy way to here's the title of the thing plot wise. You know, here's the information that you're going to get. It's not a great assignment, but it's fine for like well, here's how we're getting this information to you.
Yeah, I know. I just
it's more grabbing than just witch burning in the 14th century.
I don't like it. Snape also makes them write an essay about shrinking solutions, right?
Shrinking potions.
I'm like, what kind of essay are you going to write about that?
How to make it or
oh, that would just effects, be a list long, of instructions,
long term consequences. How to circumvent.
I just have a problem with these teachers assigning summer homework, first of all, and secondly, the instructional methods used at Hogwarts continue to be a problem for me.
That's fair. I mean, Harry seems to be happy to do any kind of magic something.
I guess, yeah. That's something else that I think that we sometimes miss, that like as much as Harry is a jock, Harry's also a big old nerd sometimes for magic stuff.
Yeah.
And like, you can't blame him with the environment that he lives in.
He's desperate for any kind of magic, so writing an essay and being like, oh no, I better not spill my ink.
Yeah.
That he's really excited about that.
Yeah. So he's writing this essay. He does mention Wendolin the Weird. And that name is stuck in my brain from the Chamber of Secrets Game Boy Color game, which is the best Harry Potter game in existence. There is a subquest in that game where you like progressively trade a bunch of items to get like a dragon skin coat or something by the end of it. And at one point you get a misprint of a Wendolin the Weird wizarding card. So I just, okay. I always remember that name. An interesting inconsistency, though, with this. In the book, Harry's writing about how Wendolin the Weird was burned at the stake no less than 47 times. The wizard card in the games says she was burned 14 times.
Was that the misprint?
Pottermore later affirmed 47. But no, it wasn't the misprint of the Wendolin the Weird card that said the 14 times.
Okay.
Yeah. So just a fun little tidbit there for you if you care as much as I do about Wendolin the Weird.
And you should.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. She liked to dress up and be burned at the stake.
Yeah. It's a pretty good story.
Then we get into a lovely, appropriate phone call from Ron Weasley to Vernon Dudley.
Vernon Dursley. You have to stop doing that.
Ron clearly intending to call Harry's uncle. And then yell in his face.
Yeah. I have so many questions about this. Like, just why wasn't Hermione the one to make this phone call? Like, if Ron was like, oh, we should get in touch with Harry, why wouldn't Hermione be the one to be like, I will use the phone?
I don't think they were communicating and saying, oh, let's get in touch with Harry together. It was very much Ron wanted to say hi to Harry.
So that's my other thing. Why did Ron feel the need to make a phone call in the first place? Like, why didn't he just send an owl?
Harry had the great idea at the end of the summer, at the end of last school year, to give his phone number. I was like, the mail didn't work last year. Let's try this.
Oh, right. There is that whole thing with Dobby taking the mail.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So Ron was absolutely justified in making this call. He probably... It was poor luck that Vernon Dursley answered the phone, and it did not help. Like, Ron didn't realize he was doing something wrong because after he yelled into the phone, Vernon responded by yelling back. So he thought that was the way it was supposed to go.
I also want to know what this process was like, because my other question was, why didn't Ron ask Hermione how to use the phone? Like, why wasn't Ron like, I'm trying this new thing, this new muggle thing. I know a muggle born who I can ask about this. My fear is that he asked his dad.
That's exactly what happened. He his dad set up a phone and was so excited to show Ron how to use it. He showed him how to type in the numbers. He
and then he was like, son, you have to scream.
And I think he didn't say that. I think he just walked away. He was like, this is how you hold it and you can get started. Oh, good. It's ringing. When you hear someone answer, you can start talking.
And then later in Ron's letter to Harry, he's like, Dad reckons I shouldn't have screamed.
Yeah.
This to me drips with Arthur Weasley. This to me was the influence of Arthur on Ron. I wish that Ron had applied a second of critical thought here and been like, let me ask Hermione to do this.
Yes, but again, it wasn't like they were planning to talk to Harry
I don't
together.
Know. Later books give me the impression that Ron and Hermione are like in touch with each other throughout the summers.
Yes, because they have the ability to.
Yes.
Like they're not limited by
I guess I'm assuming that they were in touch with one another this summer and that Ron should have cleared this with Hermione first.
I understand that mindset, but I don't think he was like, oh, I bet it's time for me to call Harry. I think it was just a matter of he wanted to, and that was the way he was supposed to talk to Harry. Like, I don't think he was writing to Hermione or calling Hermione and saying,
I wish there was a conversation there between them of like, hey, Hermione, have you heard from Harry in a while? No. Oh, we should call him. How about you do that?
Well, it sounds like this was the beginning of the summer.
It is, yeah.
Like, so Ron didn't wait long. He was just, oh, I want to talk to Harry.
Yeah,
let's talk
I guess
to Harry.
That is kind of a 12-year-old thing to do of like, well, I can do this new way of talking to Harry. Yeah, it is funny, though. It is.
It's a good. Very good scene. Yeah.
And again, it's another good thing to establish that world of establish who the Dursleys are and establish this divide between the Muggle and wizarding worlds. So Harry is getting sleepy. He hides his magic stuff under a loose floorboard in his room, which I really, is this just a thing that happens in like movies and TV and books? Like, do you know anybody who ever hid things under a loose floorboard in their home?
Like not from, personally, no.
From what I know about floors, which isn't a lot, I don't think that floorboards just like can pull up nice and cleanly like this. And I don't think that there's just like empty space under floorboards. Like, isn't there a subfloor?
What does that mean?
I don't know. I've watched a lot of Property Brothers and I hear them talking about the subfloor.
Okay. I would say probably a second story, like on a second story floor, if you were to pull up the floorboards, there might be space there. On the first floor, probably not.
But like when you put down hardwood, you don't just lay it over empty space. Like you don't just lay it over the rafters of the ceiling. There's a subfloor.
I mean,
like a floor under the floor.
It depends.
On what?
On how it was built. Like,
okay. And we don't know.
Yes, you could put hardwood on top of a different floor. Or you
but
put
a subfloor, not
first.
A different floor. Like, I'm not saying like they're laying the hard one on top of like linoleum or something, because that is something that people do. I'm saying that there is like plywood on the ground just to like make it safe and make it sturdier so that you can then lay your nice hardwood floor on top.
Okay. I guess you could pull both up.
You would need like a saw to do that. You'd need to cut into the subfloor.
Maybe.
Okay.
But I feel like that would be something you would have to do. Like, Harry might have spent some time moving around and like prying up a floorboard rather than like, oh, I happen to have this loose one in a convenient spot.
Okay. But you've never known anyone who hides things under their floorboards? Okay.
No. Also, most people I know have carpets in their bedrooms.
Okay.
So you can't really ply up a pull up a piece of carpet.
You sure could. But okay. Yeah. I'm just, I really wonder if like an actual human being has ever done this or if it's just a thing for movies.
Well, if you have, let us know at alpost@petrificestotalis.com.
You remembered.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. So he hides his magic stuff under a loose floorboard and he sees some owls coming in the distance.
Two conscious owls that are flying, carrying an unconscious third owl.
Yes. Who we learn is Errol, the Weasley's family bird. We did talk about Errol in 203, which was the burrow. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to get into the etymology of Errol again, but I will say that I love Errol.
Errol is a very poor old bird who really should be able to take a break.
Retire.
Be euthanized. Spend some time. No. No.
Just put it out of its misery.
No. Just let him relax. Don't send him on very long flights.
It's just like, it's kind of a mean joke when you think about it, like that the Weasleys have this old incompetent bird because they're so poor and they can't afford something better. But I like Errol.
Well, it's like all of their things are hand-me-down.
Yeah.
I'm not saying this is a hand-me-down.
Well, also
owl,
there are like 10 of the Weasleys. So like if they're all using Errol, this thing is going to be run ragged.
Yeah. But like, they probably had Errol as a baby and raised him. And he's just like, he's continued to be part of the family. No, we're not euthanizing Errol.
I'm just saying.
No.
He's getting old. He probably has a lot of health problems.
Errol can relax and retire.
He can go to Egypt with Bill and just hang out there and on vacation.
He'll sit on Bill's shoulder just like Scabber sits on Ron's.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk about that. So the owls come and deliver Harry a bunch of stuff and he opens up the first thing, which is a letter from Ron.
I think it's fun that Harry does make a big deal about this is the first birthday card I've ever gotten.
It's so sad.
Yeah, it's very sad, but like it's really just the order he happened to pick up the packages.
Yeah.
Because if he had picked up Hermione's first, that would have been the first birthday card.
Yeah.
Or Hagrid's first, that would have been the first birthday card.
But Ron's is first.
Ron's is first.
I mean, Ron is like number one. Like, let's be honest, Ron is Harry's best friend.
They're both his best friend.
I think Ron gets like
plus Hagrid
priority.
Is also his best friend.
Okay, all right. So Harry opens up this letter from Ron and is basically just wishing him a happy birthday and telling him about and including a newspaper clipping about the annual Daily Prophet Grand Prize Galleon Draw, which the Weasleys won. Basically, they won the lottery.
700 galleons.
Yes. 700 galleons, which I did do the conversion in 1993 US dollars. That is $5,197.59. In 2020 dollars, that is $4,665.96.
It went down?
Yeah.
Okay.
Basically, like the dollar doesn't go as far in 2020 as it did in 1993.
Okay.
So it adjusts for that.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So they won this money, which is a substantial amount of money, especially if you're dirt poor like the Weasleys.
Yes.
This weirdly sets a lot of things into motion in this book and in this series. And we can't really get into it beyond that
later. But it truly is just like
what
this
a stupid
fun
little
trip.
Thing.
This fun little trip they go on starts a lot.
It does. It really sets things off. So Ron encloses a picture of him and his family in Egypt because they went there to visit Bill on vacation. Percy is wearing his head boy badge on a fez.
Yep. He pinned it to his hat.
Yep.
Like every head boy does.
Ron has Scabbers on his shoulder and they're all just kind of smiling and waving. How do you feel about the Weasleys going on this vacation? Because this has been something that people have discussed.
So.
Nerds, I mean.
I wouldn't really relate this directly to people who win the Mega Millions and go even more broke.
No, because it's not like
no,
you won $200 million.
Yeah.
Like they won a modest amount of money.
They weren't set for life from
no.
this if they had treated it wisely. If you do compare it to in the previous book when they go to the bank and they have a single galleon.
Yeah.
That's a lot compared to what they had. And they spent almost all of it on a trip. But they spent it on a vacation with their family where they got to see more of their family. They went to visit their son.
That's kind of where I land on it. That like maybe it's not the most financially responsible plan. We do have to keep in mind, too, we don't know how much of this money they spent on the vacation.
Ron says most.
Oh, okay. 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 That's different. But so they did spend a lot of money on this vacation, obviously. But I kind of agree with you that, like, it's something that they did with their family. They probably don't get to see Bill that often. So, like, I don't know. And, you know, there's that whole thing now about, like, buying experiences, not things.
Yes. And we know that the Weasleys could have money if they wanted to. We know that the other wizards that are loaded because they are old money. They were, like, charging the muggles that moved onto their property, that kind of thing. And the Weasleys just let muggles use their property. They weren't, like, enforcing themselves as landlords because they were there first.
Yeah.
They were
the most evil people possible, landlords.
They were just generous with everything they had. Yeah. I don't think if they didn't go on this trip, I still don't know if it would have, like, lasted that long because of, like, they've made it very far without needing that money. I don't think they would have been like, oh, well, now we're set. Now we need to save this up.
Yeah, that's my thing. I think it tracks with their character that, like, of course they're going to spend the money on family.
Yes.
That's just who they are. And, like, if that's their worst quality, that they're bad at managing money because they spend it to see their family and do things with their family, like, what a darling little family they are. I love the Weasleys. And they do set aside some of it for necessities. Like, Ron does say that they are getting him a new wand. Thank goodness.
Yes.
So, like, I think that they were fairly responsible with it.
Again, maybe not responsible, but they used it in a good way.
Sure. Okay. Maybe that's a better way of framing
it. And, like, if you're saying the other option was, what if you just give them all new clothes? They're not that kind of people.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So I'm okay with it. People have kind of hotly debated this over the years with people like, they're so poor and they just squander all their money and that kind of, I don't know. So they use the money to go visit Egypt, to visit Bill. Bill is a curse breaker.
Yes.
That is his job, which, as far as I can tell, is a treasure hunting archaeologist.
This is magic Indiana Jones.
Yeah. And I kind of question what they're doing with the goods he finds in Egypt.
I thought it was going to museums or something.
That's what I would like to think.
Who is the one that works for the bank?
Bill.
Okay, so it's going to the bank, I guess.
Yeah, it kind of reeked of, like, it throughout history, the English kind of going to other places and, you know, taking cultural artifacts to put in their museums and enrich them. It felt kind of icky, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, that's fair.
Like, as cool as a curse breaker seems and as, like, tight as a dude I'm sure Bill is, I don't know about this one.
That's fair. But we don't have a ton of details. We can optimistically say he's breaking the curses so that it's safer for people to, like, be regular tourists.
Well, that's an interesting thing because curse breakers do come up later on when the characters are discussing, like, potential careers. And we do learn that you need a background in muggle studies to be a curse breaker. So I'm wondering if maybe, like, Bill is a very specific type of curse breaker to be in Egypt doing this stuff. Whereas, like, a normal curse breaker would maybe be doing kind of what Arthur does, like finding things
like muggle
that,
artifacts.
Yeah. And, have been bewitched and are hurting people. Yeah. So I found that interesting. I couldn't really find too much background on what exactly a curse breaker or what exactly Bill is doing. Another thing that we learned from Ron's letter is that they've been going into all these tombs and taking tours. And he's saying, like, oh, the last one was so scary that my mom wouldn't let Ginny go in. And this just reminded me so much of, as a child, me and my sibling Den played soccer as kids, but my mom wouldn't let my other sister, guest star of 218, Becca, play soccer because she worried that Becca was too frail for it and that she would get beaten up by the vicious other kids on the soccer field. And so this just kind of reminded me of that. Like, it's kind of nice to know that Molly is protective of Ginny, I think, because she's the youngest and because she's the only girl.
Yeah, but also it's mostly, like, she's very young to see what is described as cursed corpses.
Yeah. I like that idea. I also like that, like, Ron is only a year older than Ginny, and Molly's just kind of like, well, he's lost. Like, I can't do anything more there, but I have my last shot with Ginny. I can protect Ginny. Mm-hmm. So I just got a kick out of that.
I could also see, because of the horrifying trauma she went through last year.
Oh, that's not true.
Piling onto that.
I didn't think of that. Like, that Ginny almost died 2 months ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, fair. Didn't think of that. maybe that's what inspires Molly to be a little more protective of Ginny after mm-hmm. after what she went through.
Maybe.
Yeah. Okay. Now I feel bad for goofing on that. But the other thing that Ron does is sends Harry a pocket sneakoscope as a birthday gift.
Yes. I didn't really look into the sneakoscopes more than what's explained on the page.
Yeah, there's not too much to say. They'll come up again in Goblet of Fire when we can maybe talk about them a little more.
Yeah, but they're supposed to spin and light up when someone untrustworthy is around.
Yes, which, interesting note, Ron says that Bill thought it was like a piece of junk because it kept going off. When it gets to Harry, it's not doing anything. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we'll maybe return to that later on.
Ron accuses Fred and George of being the untrustworthy ones. Mm-hmm. For
they put beetles in Bill's soup or something.
Yeah, which is disgusting.
It's mean.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like that one crosses the line. Like, usually Fred and George's pranks are like mostly harmless. Actually, I don't know about that. I think I'm going to take that back. Yeah, the spider thing and the beetles seems bad.
I would say this is on par for things they've done.
Okay.
Still gross. Yeah. I don't want to eat
beetles. No. Yeah.
And if I'm eating a beetle, I want to know it's a beetle. Like, if I'm putting a bug in my mouth, I better know it's a bug.
Okay.
Like, I've eaten, you know, the crickets, like chocolate crickets.
Oh, I hate that. Like that. I hate that. When, God, kids used to do that all the time. Like, when I was in school, they'd be like, this is the candy fly I got from like the gift store of this field trip, and I'm going to eat it in front of it. I'm just like, why? Like, why do we need this? Why did somebody think to create that?
Well, there's a push for...
Crickets are disgusting.
There is a push.
Why would you ever want to eat
there
one?
There is a push to break that.
Absolutely not. No. I don't care. Like, mindset. Oh, they have protein in them. Ugh. Ugh.
A more environmentally friendly source of protein.
I understand the whole biology thing of like, oh, we need bugs because they are part of the food cycle and they keep our ecosystem. No, bugs are disgusting. When you have been emotionally and physically scarred the way I have been by crickets.
You were bit once by a cricket. You didn't see the cricket bite you. You just found a bite and said it was a cricket bite.
No, you don't know the other half of the story, do you? I found the dead cricket.
Okay. But you didn't. You didn't see yourself
also,
get bit.
But
you
also my it. House just... had crickets in it all the time and I was chased by them. I don't want to eat bugs.
That's fine.
Okay.
But it's a stigma that people are trying to break it.
Okay.
You don't need to.
I don't agree with those people.
You're welcome to not eat crickets.
Good.
But there are.
Okay. There are I want to talk about Hermione's
for
gift.
People eating bugs.
Are you good with Egypt?
Am I good with Egypt?
Yeah. Are you
I think
down
Egypt
with Egypt?
And I are tight.
All right.
We're good.
Yeah. So Harry opens his next gift, which is from Hermione. She sends him a broomstick maintenance kit, which I think is a thoughtful present.
Yes. And it's better than what Harry was thinking. I was like, oh, it's going to be a book.
Yeah. And better than later presents that she gives. I won't say what specifically because I'm so excited to talk about it when we get there. But Hermione sends some real bad presents later on. In Half-Blood Prince, she gives both Harry and Ron homework planners.
That sounds right. I mean, how many planners have you gotten me?
A lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she sends the broomstick maintenance kit, which I think is both like a thoughtful and a practical gift. You know,
yes.
Like it serves a purpose. And it's also like, you know, Harry loves Quidditch. This would be a nice thing for. I was really like, oh, Hermione, this is nice.
It was also a very convenient way for J.K. Rowling to bring up Quidditch.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of things in this chapter that just like neatly tie into here's how we're just going to exposition this.
Yeah. So it includes like some polish and something to trim the bristles and a little compass for when you're on a flight. And
this really does
a guide.
It really does sound like something you would order out of a magazine.
I mean, she did say she like mail ordered it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It just truly like.
Remember ordering out of magazines?
No, I never did. Oh, most okay. of them were junk.
Okay. The Delia's catalog was a. You know, staple.
The clothing
yeah.
catalog? Okay.
Yeah.
Other Are they all shut down them. Or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. We would also like go through the Lego catalog and like circle the things that we wanted. And like every page was circled. yes. I do want to talk about Fleetwood's high finish handle polish. I tried to look into this to see if there's anything about like what this means as far as Fleetwood, because I was like Fleetwood, like because I'm my mother's daughter. So I was like Fleetwood, like Fleetwood Mac. And so I was like, oh, is Fleetwood a type of wood? It's not. Surprise. it's like a place in England, apparently. And I think one of the band members in Fleetwood Mac's last name is Fleetwood. I'm sorry, Mom, if you're listening to this, I've disappointed you again.
but also, if you are listening to this, keep in mind, she has researched and taken so many notes and she chose not to look this one up.
I did look it up. I just did not read very far into it. Yeah, I couldn't really find anything interesting about why it might be called Fleetwood. My headcanon is that it's a Fleetwood Mac reference. Hermione does note a customs concern. She thought about mailing this to Harry, but she was like, oh, and then Hedwig showed up and it was perfect.
This seems like the most inconspicuous thing to get through customs of like, this is just polish
and
a compass. In a bag labeled broom care. Like broom
I mean, but
stick.
If it's like, there's like a manual in there about how to maintain your broomstick.
I suppose, but like.
I feel like it wouldn't raise too many questions.
I don't think at all it would have really raised questions. It's convenient that Hedwig delivered it for her, but.
So I want to talk about this, though, the customs thing. I found this note on the Harry Potter Wiki on a page about mistakes in the Harry Potter series. This was noted in her letter accompanying the broomstick servicing kit that she sent to Harry from France. Hermione expresses concern over the possibility of the package being opened at customs. However, the UK was in the European Union in 1993, so there would not have been any customs checks on goods arriving from France.
Okay.
Yeah. I thought maybe, though, that because she had to mail away from it for it, like if the company was located, you know, not in France, like not in the European Union, then it would have to pass through customs. You get what I'm saying?
Okay.
Yeah. Because she didn't buy it in France.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. I just thought that was interesting. Let's talk about Hagrid's gift. I put gift in quotation marks in my notes.
I would call it a gift. It's very thoughtful. One less thing
to buy. Is it thoughtful? Did he think about this? Did he really think about this?
He genuinely did. He was like, this is the coolest way to show off a surprise I have for him. I'm not going to spoil the surprise yet.
He could have like included a helpful tip.
There is a helpful tip that we get later on.
Later on, not in the letter.
That would have been useful, but a belt works too. So Harry does open up a box that before he opens it snaps at him, and Harry thinks back to all the other dangerous creatures that Hagrid has dealt with.
Dragon eggs, three-headed dogs, giant spiders.
Yeah. And Harry thinks to himself, there's no way he would send me something dangerous.
Could it be?
And to an extent, it's not dangerous. It's a living book that tries to bite him and successfully bites him.
Yeah.
But it's still a book.
So to what extent is it not dangerous?
It's still a book. So like, yes, a book slammed on your finger might hurt, but it's not like something to fear. Like he's able to just wrestle that book and put a belt on it.
I would be afraid if a book started attacking me.
Yes, but you're a muggle.
Okay.
I don't know. If it had teeth, that'd be a different question. But it was just like paper on paper smashing into his fingers. And, you know, he wasn't hurt from it.
Okay.
Just some pain.
Okay. Just I question the decision-making skills here with Hagrid.
He made other people buy that.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about why Harry's going to need this book later on.
Yeah.
Hagrid says it's a surprise.
It is a surprise.
It is a surprising gift as well. So that's what Hagrid sends. Not much to say about his letter. He does write at the end, "Hope the muggles are treating you right," which yep. I thought was good. And then Harry opens the last item, which is his Hogwarts letter.
Just going back to "Hope the muggles are treating you right."
Yeah.
All three of them who wrote him letters just refer to them as muggles.
Yeah.
And not like "hope your family," "hope the Dursleys."
It's called dehumanization, Joe.
hope the muggles are treating you right. Or "I hope that phone call didn't make things worse between you and the muggles."
Yeah. I mean, but that's kind of how the wizarding world sees them. It does seem odd. I don't know if Hermione uses that language. Because that would feel weird if Hermione was like, "Oh, the muggles."
That's not how she ends the letter, at least. Let's see when she talks about... No, she does not refer to them as muggles. Okay. But she is...
She's a muggle. Or she's muggle-born. Yeah, so for her to be like, "Ugh, hope those muggles ain't bothering you," would be weird because her parents are muggles.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the last thing that Harry gets is the letter from Hogwarts with like, "Hey, here's what you'll need. Here's some information about like when to get the train and when the school year is starting." And it includes a permission slip for visiting Hogsmeade because third year students are permitted to visit Hogsmeade on the weekends. And Harry needs to get a permission slip signed by his parent / guardian.
Yes.
So this plot thread will continue. I do want to talk a little bit about Hogsmeade. I couldn't find too much about the name Hogsmeade. Galadriel had some interesting speculation. She said that a hog's head is a barrel / keg. And we know that Hog's Head is a pub in Hogsmeade because that's where Hagrid got the dragon egg. Mm-hmm. I never knew that a hog's head was a barrel or keg.
No, I didn't either.
Yeah. And mead obviously is a type of ale.
Yes, so, it is honey and fruit, I believe.
Okay. That sounds like something you would like.
Yeah, it is.
Okay. So that's really all I could find about the name. I think there's an obvious connection there with like Hogwarts, Hogsmeade, because Hogsmeade is like the village by Hogwarts. Mm-hmm. Where the hog part of that came from, like why Rowling was like, "Yeah, we gotta get those pigs in there." I don't know. But that is what I found about the name Hogsmeade. And Hogsmeade is, of course, going to be very important to this book. And I think it's another thing that this book does differently in that it kind of expands the setting of the book.
Yeah, we get more than just the inside of the school.
Yeah.
We're getting nearby areas. And Harry notes that this is a fully magical town.
Yeah.
And the only other area that we know of at this point in this story as readers is Diagon Alley, which is not really a full village.
Yeah.
It's an alley.
Yeah. And so like the previous books, obviously, you know, they've gone to Diagon Alley. He went to Nocturne Alley. There was the Burrow. And so they kind of like built out the setting a little bit. But I think Hogsmeade is the first like really big addition that we've gotten since the first book. And the first book was just establishing things. So I think that's interesting. And I think that future books will continue to kind of like push that boundary of where we've experienced in the wizarding world.
Yeah.
So again, a kind of difference to note with this book. And I think that it helps kind of mature the book up a bit, you know, push it into that young adult territory of like there is a space for them to go where they're not supervised. Everything that they've done in Hogwarts has either been like under teacher supervision or trying to skirt away from teacher supervision, you yes. know, like
and
sneaking
out
at night.
And this is like, here's almost a safe haven.
Yeah. Like here's a sanctioned place that you can go and spend your time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's another thing that helps to inject kind of that, you know, adult stuff into it, that they're not always under like an adult's eye. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was that. And that's kind of the chapter. The ending is a little saccharine. It's like, you know, as unusual as Harry was, he had one thought of like he was happy it was his birthday for the first time ever or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I thought was a little saccharine, but it was still good. You know, I like that it kind of returned to that framing device
of like, oh, he's an unusual boy.
Yeah.
But he's finally happy it's his birthday.
Yeah.
Despite that last little bit of difficult news.
Yeah. I mean, compared to his last birthday, this is pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's worried about how he's going to get that permission slip signed. That's the last bit of news Joe was referring to. But yeah, that's the chapter.
Yes, it is. Which means it's time for Spell of the Week.
Oh, you got to do it with more gravitas than that.
Spell of the Week.
There we go.
Week.
I can just apply reverb. You don't have to do it. Okay.
This week, we're going to be looking back at how completely useless witch burning was.
Oh, okay. Didn't know where you were going with that.
Well, I know
the word they used was pointless.
Oh, well, yes. Pointless, useless, did not accomplish anything. Because of this spell, the flame freezing charm. The incantation is unknown, but there were some extra added details on the Harry Potter wiki that I'd like to point out. In the chapter, it is mentioned that an actual wizard, witch or wizard, would be able to use the flame freezing charm and just feel a tickle, which is horrifying in a lot of ways, because when people went after non-witches, they were just burned at the stake.
Yeah.
So it was useless or pointless in many ways, in killing muggles and not killing witches.
To be clear, when I disputed the assignment, I was not like, yeah, let's burn those witches. Like, yeah. I'm not pro witch burning.
But what witch or wizard was going to be like, no, you're right. There was a point to it.
Yeah, I guess. I guess there's not really like a pro argument there.
They should have been doing it. Yes, so this charm worked on any living creatures or objects. So you could put it on, you know, a house or something that's like an object, something that's not alive.
Oh, okay. So it wouldn't set on fire.
To prevent it from being set on fire. This changes the sensation of burning so that instead gave a sensation such as a warm summer breeze or a gentle tickling sensation. But it did not. It'll work on non-living objects, but won't work on dead flesh.
Oh, good to know.
So there is no spell. There has been no spell found to prevent dead flesh from burning.
Okay. So if you apply this spell to your house and then your house sets on fire and you're inside of it, would you feel the tickle or would just your house feel the tickle?
Well, your house wouldn't burn. Your house can't feel things, though.
Okay. But you're inside the house. Does the tickle transfer?
Is the spell on you?
I'm asking.
If you cast the spell on yourself,
you're inside of the house.
But if the inside of the house is on fire and you are not protected by the spell, you are now on fire.
I'm saying the house sets on fire and you're in the house. The house doesn't, there's no fire because the spell was done. You're inside. Do you get tickled?
So when you burn a witch, there is a fire beneath them.
Okay.
So that's what's on
fire.
So
the witch doesn't, tickles them.
The witch doesn't catch fire.
Okay, so the fire tickles them.
Yes.
So if the house is on fire, or the house...
The house is not on fire.
The house is not on fire. I guess you don't feel the tickle. But if you're inside the house and the house is on fire, but you cast the spell on yourself, then you feel the tickle.
Yes.
Okay, just needed to clear that up. That was important.
Yes. So the objects or people or any living creature
are tickled by the fire.
Yes. They cannot be burned.
And is the important part. They're tickled by the fire.
Yes.
The tickling is, I think, the most important part.
Well, it's one thing if you tickle and still get burned. It's another thing if you just don't get burned. There are people who don't have the sensation of pain. This is an uncommon thing. Real people.
Does that mean they can't be tickled?
Pain is what I said.
Is tickling a form of pain?
Is tickling a form of pain?
I'm asking. You brought us here.
So they can burn themselves, but it's a danger because they can accidentally burn themselves and not realize. If you touch something hot, they might feel it's warm.
Okay,
but
where are you going with this? What does this have to do with the spell?
The important distinction between getting burned and not getting burned. So you could...
Yeah, with the spell, you don't actually set on fire.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't know why you're... Yes, it's fun that they get tickled. But it's more of just a way of saying they're not feeling pain. It's just like...
Yeah, just a tickle.
Just a tickle.
Yeah. I think tickling can be painful sometimes.
Okay.
Okay. Please, somebody count how many times we said tickle in that like 2-minute span. Is that all it for the spell of the week?
that's truly all the information we had, which is why we had to stretch it so much by saying tickle so many times.
That's why. All right. So with spell of the week done, we are going to go into emails. You can send an email to owlpost@potrificustotalis.com with your questions, your corrections. You can talk about tickling if you want.
Owl, not too much, though.
Just a little.
Just a little bit of tickling.
Yeah. I mean, that's how you want to be tickled. You want just a little bit of tickling, not too much.
We can't. owlpost@potrificustotalis.com.
Yes.
Since we last put an episode out.
Yeah.
Did we get a single email?
A single email. I do want to say, though, that this chapter is called Owl Post.
Yes.
And our email address is owlpost.petrificustotalis.com. Isn't that fun?
We named it after this specific chapter and that Owl Post is a thing.
In the morning. Yeah.
In the morning?
Yes. So Owl Post in the morning. Okay. the email is from Marlin. Thank you, Marlin. And it reads, "Hello, my name is Marlin. I love your podcast and I'm currently on episode 213. This was several months ago, so Marlin's probably caught up by now. I want to talk about Peeves. Peeves is a poltergeist, not a ghost. A poltergeist is a manifestation of mischief, whereas a ghost is a human spirit. Peeves cannot be gotten rid of because there is always mischief at Hogwarts, so he'll just return as long as there is mischief. The more mischief, the stronger the poltergeist. Thank you for your time. Love the podcast. Keep up the good work."
So Peeves is at his highest power when the twins are around.
Yeah. I'm guessing that at some point one of us may have mistakenly referred to Peeves as a ghost.
I think you were saying, why don't they just get rid of Peeves?
Okay. Yeah. So I appreciate that correction. Thank you. Yeah, I think I like that bit about the more mischief, the stronger the poltergeist, because like you said, that there's a lot of mischief happening right now.
Oh, yeah.
And I like the idea of there's always mischief at Hogwarts. So Peeves will always be there, because I think that it's kind of a fun tradition of mischief at Hogwarts. And sometimes that mischief can be borderline bullying. Sometimes it's full out bullying, which we'll talk about with this book.
But mischief is mischief.
Mischief is mischief. And there's certainly a lot of mischief there. So thank you, Marlin, for your email. Hopefully you enjoy having it followed up several months after you sent it. And everyone else can feel free to send an email again to owlpost@petrificustotalis.com. With that said, that is our episode, unless you want to talk about tickling some more. No? Okay. So that is our episode. So we do encourage you to check us out on Twitter @Podtrificus. We have a Facebook page, I think.
Do we? Why?
Just because, I don't know. I don't use it. So follow us on Twitter.
So we made it so that it could just sit there empty?
I think I have it auto-post our Twitter posts to Facebook. Right.
Well, yeah. Like us on Facebook.
Yeah, you can like us on Facebook. You can go to our website, podtrificustotalis.com, which has all of our episodes. You can listen to them there. You can download them. You can check out the show notes. I do put a lot of work into the show notes, linking back to the things that we reference. So you can definitely check that out. It has transcripts for some of the episodes and so on. And of course, you can subscribe to us wherever you find podcasts so that you get the latest episodes as soon as they come out.
Whenever that actually happens.
On their release schedule, always as planned, never a gap. So yes, we're on all the major podcast services. I do want to do a quick plug for the By the Brick podcast, which I was on September 1st. I believe I did retweet them, but in case you missed that, you can certainly go back and listen to that. The By the Brick podcast is a Lego podcast. I was on their special bricking pod for a new Diagon Alley set that came out. So I got to talk about how much I like Harry Potter and how much I like Lego, which is frankly a dream come true. I don't know why we didn't just make this a Lego podcast.
unfortunately, being on that podcast did not come with free
gosh, that's my goal, really, ultimately, to maneuver this podcast into me getting free things, i.e. Legos.
We have quite a few of the Harry Potter Legos.
Yes,
right,
and
now
we've spent quite a bit of money on them.
They take up a a decent chunk of our apartment.
Yes. Yes. So do check that out. It was the episode that came out on September 1st, the special bricking pod for Diagon Alley. I was there. I had a lot of fun. So you can certainly listen to me on that. Otherwise, you can listen to me on the next episode of Podtrificus Totalis, Chapter 2 of Prisoner of Azkaban.
Aunt Marge's big mistake.